The Guardian.
Hello, I'm Nat Coombs and welcome to Guardian Football Weekly. I'm sitting in for Max this week and it's business as usual as my guests and I pick up after a weekend where a Man City coach was beaten for the second time in a week. Arsenal and Southampton decided a five-goal thriller wasn't quite enough drama at the Emirates, so obliged with a couple of reds for good measure. The Merseyside derby was assuredly anticlimactic, and not a single team in the bottom half of the Premier League picked up a win. So, amongst other things, we'll try and work out who exactly that benefits. Elsewhere, we'll discuss a frantic end to Cardiff vs Wolves in the Championship and Accrington Stanley's burgeoning burger habit. We'll chat to Sid Lowe in Spain, hear from our experts on the climaxes to the other major European leagues, and get into your questions too. That's all coming up on today's Guardian Football Weekly. John Costa has tweeted us, suggesting no Max, but the guests are perfect. And you know what? He's right on both counts. Barry Glendening, good to see you. How's life?
Very well. Thank you.
Lars Sivertsen, we can pretend, well, for the purposes of audio, that we haven't seen each other for ages, but it was, what, 12 hours since we were in
this just studio. About 12 hours. I was going to make a joke, but you've gone...
I've crashed
yeah,
it already.
Yeah, you have, yep.
Well, we did work out we're an incredibly bad influence on each other last night.
We did, because I think we're both usually sort of very competent gamblers, you know? We take out more than we deposit, by and large, but we completely reinforced our own worst influences last night and went on a spectacular losing run whilst we were on air. I don't think the listeners knew about, but we can reveal now to the Guardian listeners.
One word I've got on that is Marseille, Philippe Beauclerc. Yes. The reason why we tilted so badly.
Yes, I'm afraid that we'll talk about this later, but you had forgotten who Marseille were playing.
The mighty defence of Montpellier. Heavy duty
coffee.
Were
you sort of getting progressively more narky with each other and life in general as the radio show progressed?
It was a five-hour show and it started so promisingly. We were full of joy and the spirit of spring, weren't we? And then, yeah, by the end, it was a bad sitcom from the 80s.
And I also spent an unreasonable amount of time discussing just why Marseille haven't been awarded a penalty when they shouldn't have gotten a penalty. That would have privately helped me out in a big way.
I started prepping this show by the end of proceedings, I think. Anyway, it's lovely to be working alongside all of you. Let's get straight into it. And we'll start with the Manchester derby, which, of course, finished 3-2 to Man United. It felt to me, Philippe Auclair, and you were at the game, of course.
I was at the game, yes. It was a lucky bunny.
It was like a footballing episode of Twin Peaks in some ways, simultaneously captivating and then utterly baffling. If you look at where we were at with it, 2-0 at halftime, and City could have been 5-0 up.
Yeah.
Their fans were working out what kind of celebrations they were going to be doing. Bookies were paying out on Man City.
Were they?
At halftime, yeah. And then we all know what happened. The question is, why did it happen? What do you put down that second half?
I think I could explain Twin Peaks and the way that David Lynch's mind functions better, perhaps, than what happened on the baffling thing we saw on Saturday, which was basically two sides of a very odd coin. As in, I've never seen anything like this happen before in my life. We tried desperately to find an equivalent, not just in England, but in any other league, and we couldn't in history. City should have been 4-5 goals to the good at halftime. They actually even had a great chance at the beginning of the second. And then suddenly everything fell apart as soon as they got a goal against them, which is becoming a little bit of a bad habit because it is similar to what happened not just in the Champions League against Liverpool, but also at Anfield. It's like these blitzes. Suddenly they seem to lose their composure. And as to explaining why it happened, I don't know. It's a psychological meltdown, perhaps, on City's side, combined with a genuine reaction, psychological reaction, more than tactical, by the way. And that's interesting because we had a chance afterwards. I talked to a few of the players and talked for quite a long time with Andrea Herrera, who is one of the most articulate, certainly, players that you can hope to play against, to talk with. What did I say, play against? And he said there were no tactical switches at halftime. Perhaps there was a quiet word in Paul Pogba's ear, play a bit further up the pitch, but it was all about 2-0, we're a bit lucky. We're still in this. We have to show pride. The old style kind of team talk given by Mourinho, which had an extraordinary impact on them. And they were transformed and fully deserved what happened their way. Even though you have to say there were still elements in the game which could have made it go the other way. Mm. the penalty and red card, you know, Ashley Young, Raheem Sterling hitting the post, all this sort of thing. So it was chaos. But yes, we can analyze, and I see, I'm looking at the papers this Monday morning, and I think there's a lot of overreaction. I see it titled the end of an aura, which is not, you know, it's not bad, but maybe yes, maybe not. People asking themselves, what happened? Is basically, is Guardiola finished? I'm not joking. I'm only half exaggerating here. Sure. But on the other hand, you could say that, yeah, there are questions that you can ask now of Guardiola's attitude towards these games. You can also ask questions about, did he ask too much of his players early on in the season? It's true that they do look physically not quite as bright as they have been, and especially with the kind of game that he demands from his players, all this high-pressing, high-intensity game. It's true that the late goals have dried up. It's true that some of the players were not quite at the level required. And it's also true that Manchester United showed resources that, honestly, they haven't shown enough this season. But what can you say beyond the fact as well that it's a game that I think is going to be played and replayed for a very, very long time, one of the very best games of Premier League football I've ever been to?
That revisionism is interesting, Barry, because apparently City aren't that good after all, and they're fragile, and we're very much of that what have you done for me lately generation. So on the back of those two performances, you can understand why people are saying that, why that is being put out there. But in the grand scheme of things, they're going to win the title comfortably. They are still alive and kicking in the Champions League. So putting the revisionism aside, where does this
kicking
Guardiola's City twitching incarnation
alive and twiddling their toes,
breathing, they're breathing.
if you've ever gone fishing, like if you catch a flounder, they're very sturdy animals. Like they'll stay alive for a very long time. In fact, if you, I've experienced them sort of flopping about a bit, like hours after they've been there. That's, I think that's where City are in the Champions League now.
They're floundering.
Yeah, well.
Ooh, nice.
If they manage to wiggle their way into the water, you know, it could. Still,
we'll talk about Tuesday in a minute. This Guardiola City incarnation, where does it rank, do you think? How good is this team?
I don't think it's the best team ever to play in the Premier League or the First Division. I think, you know, there are various Liverpool and Manchester United teams who could lay claim to that accolade, but they're certainly getting there, and I wouldn't read too much into these two defeats. I mean, the fact of the matter is they should have won that game comfortably by half time on Saturday. They were brilliant in that first half, mesmeric at times. But Manchester United clung on, rode their luck, and made the absolute most of it. And once they got the first goal of the second half, you thought, oh, hold on, there's a chance. And, you know, the transformation in Pogba over the two halves was remarkable. Chris Smalling, who's clearly a very weak link in that Manchester United team, was badly at fault for the first goal, as he was in similar circumstances, I think in almost identical circumstances back in 2012. And, you know, hanging out of company's shirt, still couldn't stop him scoring with a header. And but he ends up, you know, being the hero with the match-winning goal. So while it was an amazing game, I don't think there's a huge amount and a huge psychological blow for City by their City rivals. I don't think we need to read too much into it. Suggestions that this exposes Guardiola as some sort of charlatan are wildly over.
Wild overreaction. Based on what we saw from him, Pogba, that is, in this game, was Mourinho right to drop him earlier in the season? Jamie Jackson, in his piece for The Guardian this weekend, suggested that was the case. What do you think, Lars?
It's an interesting facet to Mourinho's man-managing style, is that the way he puts players under pressure, publicly or privately, or both, is that if they then play well, you can say, oh, well, he's responded to the brilliant man-management. And if he doesn't, you can say, oh, well, he's not up to it, he's too weak. So it's kind of a no-lose situation for him PR-wise. Mm. And I'm not sure I'd go that far. What we certainly saw is that it's interesting that both goals came after he made runs into the box, which is runs he can only make if he's played in this midfield three that there's been so much talk about. If he's playing as one of the two double pivots, there's no way he can make that run into the box because he'd leave a huge hole in midfield and it'd be very bad. So it is a case in point of why you have to play him in a slightly more advanced position in the field.
How much of this victory for Manchester United would you... How much of the credit would you give to Mourinho over the players? I'm inclined to think it's the players rather than him. But people will say, possibly with some justification, is because I'm not a fan of his work. But because I believe Carrick and Ashley Young gave rousing speeches in the dressing room at halftime. You know, we're going to look like imbeciles here if we don't stop turning this around. So
Smalling attributed that to Marina, didn't he? So you're going to come across as clowns if you let them beat you and we go down this. I mean, do you give credit to Mourinho at all for the motivational shift? We talked about psychology.
But I don't know. See,
I mean, at least you can credit him for letting his players speak out and put their message across, which is also a quality. If he's felt that it was what he had to do to let the big guys in the dressing room speak out, and you know, nothing wrong with that. And you have to say as well that the way they reacted, it was not entirely just about pride. I mean, they were actually very well organized in the second half. They played some very good football. Would you say they played the best football of the season? And again, you know, you've got to insist all the time on the fact that there were incidents in the game which could make us say something completely different. It was a red card. Definitely Ashley Young, that was a pen and a red card. Everybody agrees on this. And we wouldn't be talking about all this right now. So this is why I keep thinking back, you know, it is organized chaos. But this said, we learned, I think, quite a lot. We didn't understand necessarily, but we learned.
What the same thing on Tuesday then? If Liverpool score, is that curtains for City?
Yep. You never can tell. First game at the Etihad, 5-0 to City. Liverpool has the better of the game. Mo Salah, I think, misses one big chance. They open the scoring, but they're still under the cosh. Sadio Mane gets sent off. They've got to, you know, salvage something, and they ship 5 goals. Mm. Anything can happen. But if Liverpool were to score first, yeah, that's curtains, absolutely.
Speaking of revisionism, I said alive and kicking, and then we moved down to, what did we agree, breathing, and then...
Alive and floundering.
We ended up on floundering.
A Liverpool goal would be a hammer to the noggin of the beached turbot that is Man City's Champions League champion.
So Jake French asks on Twitter, if Man City don't go through in the Champions League, could their season be viewed as a bit of a disappointment internally with only 2 trophies?
I think it could be, yeah, because the Champions League, for all the contempt in which their fans certainly used to hold UEFA and the tournament, is, I'm sure, the one that City's owners want to win. You know, it sends a message across Europe. And, you know, any season you win a league title is a good season, I would argue. But I think, you know, if they lose against Liverpool and, say, for example, lose against Spurs at Wembley, there is a danger of the gloss being taken off a season in which they played some scintillating football, kept everyone entertained for long periods of time, and will win the title. I mean, there was amusing pictures of a City fan sobbing in the stands after the game on Saturday, and you're just looking at him going, you know, compared to the misery City fans are used to endure in recent decades, you know, this really... is a good time to be a City fan. So, cynics will say that, it wasn't all that. But, you know, they'll have won the title and they'll have played some wonderful, wonderful football along the way. And there's not too much of that about.
I'm going to stick one more in on that basis back to United quickly. Who's most and least likely to be at Old Trafford next season out of Mourinho, Pogba and Sanchez? Most and least likely. Who wants to lead off with that one?
I think Marino will definitely be there. Mm-hmm. I think if they got hammered in this game, which looked likely for quite some time, it possibly could have sped the end for him. Ooh. But I think on the back of this, because he's now masterminded victory over Chelsea, Arsenal, Tottenham and City. Has it? And
Liverpool.
And Liverpool. Yeah. So, you know, that's good.
Yeah.
Shows they can compete with the best, even if the style of play isn't always aesthetically pleasing. I think Sanchez will definitely be there. So, of the three, Pogba's probably the most likely to go, but I don't think they'll sell him either.
Okay, so that leaves United 13 points behind City, 4 points ahead of Liverpool and Spurs. And speaking of Liverpool, a marginally less exciting derby on Merseyside. Not without incident, though. Most notably, a visibly disgruntled Wayne Rooney, one of the headline acts. After he was substituted, he demonstrated his disgruntlement at that. Sam Allardyce was not a happy chap. He can say to me what he wants inside the office, says Big Sam, which opens up all kinds of things. Where are we, first of all, gents, on petulance from players when they're being subbed? Because it seems quite inconsistent that players are often accused of not caring and there's not enough passion and it's all about the money. And then when they demonstrate that kind of passion and energy, they're being disrespectful.
But this just reminds me of during his long and glorious reign as England manager, Big Sam did once say that it's not for me to say where Wayne Rooney plays. So it's that sort of level of discipline he's already put. Maybe it's not for him to say how Wayne Rooney reacts to being subbed either. No, I made a huge mistake on Saturday because I woke up with a bit of a headache and I sort of reached for some painkillers and I accidentally took some Night Nurse instead. And then I went on to try to watch the Merseyside Derby, which is a terrible, terrible idea. It didn't work at all. It's good to see players care. I don't mind that at all. I think that's perfect. That wasn't the problem. The problem was more, it was a Liverpool team who was just happy to sit back and save players and not get beaten.
Rightly so.
And Everton, who just weren't able to push them until the very end.
Well, they were not set up to push anything. I mean, to be honest, it was shocking. And you could hear there were moments where the Goodison crowd was booing and whistling. And they were not booing and whistling the team in possession, i.e. Liverpool. They were booing the fact that Everton were defending, so to speak, with their furthest player up the pitch, about 30 yards from Jordan Pickford. It's just at home in a Merseyside derby.
They did enough to win it.
They could have won it, right?
Yeah. A couple of chances towards the end, yeah.
On the petulance thing, you know, I don't mind it. You know, I've seen a lot of it from Richarlison, who had a great start to the season with Watford, and his form has gone off a cliff since that. You know, Marcus Silva left and that move to Everton didn't materialise in January. But I think sometimes, you know, is Rooney angry at Big Sam or is he angry at himself for not having an impact on the game? It's hard to know. Yeah. Everton fans seem to be very upset as well with Yannick Bolasie's performance. Like he was dreadful, apart from that shot he had that I think brought a brilliant save out of Karius. And that I think Karius' performance was one thing I took from a game you couldn't read a great deal into, that he has just improved so much since Klopp sort of said to him, you're my guy, you're my number one.
Last game on the bench was the 1st of January. Since then he's gone into the team. I think they've played 14 times. It's 8 clean sheets, I think, something like that, including 3 in the Champions League. And it seems he's a young man who doesn't lack confidence, shall we say, and which is wonderful for a keeper, isn't it? And but there's still a lot of talk about Liverpool being, you know, very, very interested in Alisson, who wouldn't be. But they might have actually a plan B, which is not as bad as they might have thought about 6 months ago.
I mean, if they do,
the guy who is actually currently in goal.
If they do sign else, then that would, of course, free up Karius to take on a bigger role in the next season of Game of Thrones, which, you know, given his whole look, could be a move.
It's a win-win situation.
Could be good for him. I'm really enjoying Big Sam in a sort of sadistic sort of way, because he said after the win against Brighton, and I love this, it's my job to absorb the pressure and keep it off the players and take the stick. And if it's one thing we know about Sam Allardyce, is that he will take the stick for the players, as evidenced by his other comments. After losing to Arsenal, he said, doesn't matter what system I pick, it's about the players playing to their best. You can show them, but it's up to the players. After the loss against Tottenham, they said, too many of our players decided not to defend anymore. Which is not useful. Again, but for Jordan Pickford, it could have been more. I'm hugely disappointed in the professionalism of the players. After the Watford defeat, he said, it's their responsibility at the end of the day to do better, isn't it? They get the ball and pass it, not me. You can't blame me if they don't pass the ball to each other. And now, after the game, about the strange case of Davy Klaassen, he said, if I had the opportunity to play him, I would. But I haven't, because I've got to win. So I don't have the luxury of saying, go on, give it a go, lad, because if we lose, it's me that gets the stick. So again, I mean, Sam Allardyce's approach to absorbing pressures from the player, I think, is magnificent.
It must be one of the funniest rumours of the weekend, because there are already rumours that West Brom are interested in getting him.
That's where it all began for Big Sam. As a player coach in 1989.
His first game.
If this is Big Sam taking pressure off the players, I mean, heaven knows. I'd like to see him try to put some players on.
The weird thing, though, I mean, just one last word about Big Sam. And the reason why some Everton fans, I mean, many Everton fans, are really quite upset about the way that he's making things happen or not happen. So if remember the Allardyce of his time at Bolton, his teams were a nightmare to play against. They were high pressers. They were very aggressive. They had always one or two players who had a little bit of magic in them. It was not as negative. They were not as negative. Sure. They were destructive, but in a most positive way. He seems to have completely gone out. Is it because he hasn't got the players for it? I don't know. But there is such a lack of intensity about the way Everton plays. And they reacted towards the end of the game. Calvert-Lewin coming on made a big difference, by the way. He was excellent. I don't understand how this manager can suddenly go against his own, I mean, change his own spot in so radical a fashion.
Yeah. All right, let's move on to Chelsea-West Ham, a game that Lars and I watched the majority of in our studio. First of all, before we get into the match, lovely tribute to Ray Wilkins, of course. Chelsea and West Ham fans alike singing his name, which was terrific to see. In terms of the match itself, I guess the biggest winner from the game is possibly Joe Hart. Who I think within minutes of me criticising, chastising him to Lars unequivocally, he pulls off two world-class saves in a matter of minutes. Is that a significant game for Joe Hart in terms of this question about the World Cup finals and his role within the England game? Was that exactly the kind of game he needed, Barry?
Well, I don't think there's any doubt he'll be in the squad, but I also don't think he can do enough to wrestle the number one spot back from Jordan Pickford at this stage. But obviously, playing well is better than not playing well. I don't think he has changed anything with that good performance yesterday, because I don't think there's any doubt that Gareth Southgate was ever going to bring him, you know, assuming he's fit. Just apparently he's good to have around. He won't sulk even if he's second or probably third choice keeper, but yeah, performance like that certainly isn't going to do him any harm and will help restore confidence that must have taken quite a battering this season.
But on the other hand, Jack Butland, I think, talk about world class save. I think the save from Son is just absolutely prodigious. Every time I've seen it a few times, and you might think that Son is not doing the things he should be doing, but my goodness, doesn't he save that beautifully? And so, yeah, he's probably still number three, isn't he? Surely. I mean, Pickford is at a very, very high level and has been, and he's consistent. And he also has got a bit of devil in him, which I think Southgate will like. He certainly doesn't spare his defenders when his defenders are not in the right positions. Oh, my goodness.
We talked about Everton could have won it despite the dominance from Liverpool. Similar situation, I guess, with Chelsea and West Ham, and Arnautovic was scheming. And if anything, West Ham maybe looked like the more likely winner towards the end of that game.
It is quite nice to see Arnautovic looking useful for a prolonged period of time, because he is a prodigiously gifted guy, like in terms of size and the combination of size and technique. And he's also not slow for a guy of his physical stature. Fast is not a word I'd use, but he's not as lumbering as guys of that sort of frame can often be. And I spoke to a friend of mine who used to cover Werder Bremen when he was there early in his career, and there was such a huge frustration around the club with him then, because he had so many tools, but his behaviour wasn't right and his mentality wasn't right at all. And he has throughout his career been just wildly inconsistent. But I think, having watched quite a few of his games for West Ham, I can't remember any sort of spell in which he's worked that hard over so many games. I mean, he's a guy who will often come alive when he has a point to prove, but Moyes seems to have found the buttons to push, for now, certainly. And he's got so much ability that he can hurt almost any defence he comes up against in some way, and that's very useful for West Ham to have. So, David Moyes, the Arnauto whisperer, if you will, I guess is what's going on there.
Chelsea will almost certainly have Europa League football next season. That seems to be a given. And presumably a new manager as well, Philippe.
Well, I think nobody is expecting Antonio Conte to last beyond this season. And then it's actually quite interesting to hear what the rumours circling around concerning who would be his successor. Because I've heard about Allegri, like everybody else. But I've also heard very different things, and which seem to be almost contradictory. If you take an allegory, what you're doing is that you're basically carrying on the same path that you've been treading on ever since Roman Abramovich arrived at the club, which is a very high turnover of coaches and managers, which is paying off in terms of titles, because I think in that period nobody has won more than they have. And it's paying off. And on the other hand, there was also an element in Chelsea where they were starting to think, well, we've got to think differently now. The landscape has changed in the Premier League. We now have managers who are project builders, project managers. You think Pochettino, you think Jurgen Klopp, you think Pep Guardiola, of course, perhaps and probably somebody else at Arsenal in the long term. And anyway, Wenger has been that, a project manager for very long. And a feeling perhaps that this model has run its course in the environment. Chelsea is no longer the club which has got the financial clout to beat all the others. They are not in that situation anymore. And they won't be again. So the temptation would be to go for somebody who is completely different and who is a project manager to whom you give time. So which is why people were mentioning Thomas Tuchel, of course, the name that everybody ever mentions. And I think Tuchel, Allegri, these are completely wildly different choices. And I'm not too sure that they actually have made their mind up about the direction that they want to take. Do they want to build on the fantastic academy that they've got, bring back some of those players, develop a playing style? I don't know, all these sort of things. Or do they want for a winning manager like Allegri? It's a big decision, isn't it?
It's interesting as well that Arsenal have only lost one game more than Chelsea. They have the same number of draws each. Yet all the talk this season has been of Arsenal being in total crisis and meltdown and turmoil, whereas nobody seems to have said the same thing about Chelsea at all.
But it's been a weird situation at Chelsea, because there's been an acknowledgement since halfway through the season, even before that, that the manager's probably going and it's just not going right. And everyone seems to just say, oh yeah, I guess. I take your point, Philippe. I also just think I have a theory about manager replacements, that it's a bit like what can happen in your private life with spouses and partners, that if you have a situation that goes very badly wrong, the next person you turn to tends to be the polar opposite of the person with which it went completely wrong with. I think that can often be true. And with Chelsea, of course, this theory didn't bear out at all when they went from Mourinho to Antonio Conte, because you would have thought after the sort of Mourinho experience that they would want someone a bit more chill. But of course, Antonio Conte, much of the same there. But I'm just thinking that as a club, perhaps having been through the grinder of Mourinho and the sort of intensity of Conte and his sort of constant sniping and just the difficulty of handling him, maybe they just now want a gentleman tactician. So, you know, getting Allegri in, a guy who's quite sort of a bit more relaxed and will just get on with the job and not be a pain to everyone, maybe that is the way to go.
All right, well, big point for West Ham there. Southampton falling to their third defeat in a row, despite taking an early lead at Arsenal, of course, ended up as a five-goal thriller, two red cards in the mix as well. Let's start with the latter. Any argument for either of them? They were quite bizarre, both of them, of course. Jack Stevens went first, and I guess Stevens could feel quite aggrieved given the fistful of shirt that Jack Wilshere got and reactions from other players around him, both on his side and Arsenal players, both in that situation and then the Elneny red card a little bit later on, that he was perhaps hard done by, that he saw red and Wilshere didn't. What did you make of the decision to send him off?
I think the letter of the law is interesting, because I'm guessing they've both been given reds for violent conduct. I mean, that's the only paragraph that can apply. And the letter is, a player, when not challenging for the ball, who deliberately strikes an opponent or any other person in the head or face with the arm or hand, is guilty of violent conduct unless the force used is negligible. So I guess the question is, did he strike him or was it a shove? It's a sort of weird shove-strike situation there.
There's quite a lot of shoving going on generally.
Harry Maguire got away with this identical thing the previous day, so I suppose it's up to the referee discretion.
What I also wonder is whether the referees, I have to plead ignorance here, I'm not sure if the referees have actually been given a directive that if you raise your hand, you're off. I mean, maybe they've been told so, but if they have, they're certainly not very consistent about it.
But this has to be a kind of zero tolerance for this type of thing, apart from the Maguire incident.
I felt incident. It was harsh anyway, but you see them given quite often, so I guess that's the way the referees play it. The Elneny one was particularly soft, I thought, but there was about like three yellow cards involved with what he was doing when he sort of walked over and started pushing people, flicked the ball away. It's a general shithousery, which I thought, I don't know if that's the rule, but that's...
Which brings me to a question. When a player in this kind of scuffle makes three yellow card offences, Should the referee actually take the yellow card and go one, two, three?
And lay them all down.
Do a Howard Webb, basically.
I wonder if there should be a paragraph in the rules of the game for just general annoyance. Like if you're annoying the referee to an extent that he's just really bored with you now, you should just give him a red card.
The Muff and Bummel ruling.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So when El Neni, there's no point for him going over there, starting pushing people and flicking the ball. It's just nonsense. And you, as a ref, you're stressed and you're trying to manage a heated game. I don't want to deal with this. Just go away. I mean, maybe that's what the rule should be.
Perhaps more importantly, I think Southampton, we really feel that they've missed a trick here because they were playing against a team that has completely given up on the Premier League.
Yeah.
Not all the first teamers were there. Welbeck.
Vintage Welbeck, wasn't it? Really? Missing a sitter. Social media melts down, then he scores.
Twice.
Twice. Danny Welbeck's getting sharper, says Arsene Wenger.
But this is incredibly harsh, but is that not a sentence that just encapsulates Arsenal's position right now? Just everything that's going on at Arsenal. Danny Welbeck is getting sharper.
This decline of Southampton is interesting, isn't it? Because there was, I guess, a sense of a Dortmund vibe about them insofar as they could sell a lot of their players and re-up, and it didn't seem to matter too much. But that's come off the rails now. Completely. Have they just gone too far with it?
Yeah, and I've probably said this on the podcast already, but I genuinely think there's absolutely no sense of direction at that club since it's been sold by the Liebherrs. Absolutely none. I just don't understand what they're exactly hoping for. I didn't understand the sacking of Puel. I didn't understand the appointment of Pellegrino. I don't understand their transfer dealings. I don't understand anything anymore about that club. It's very frustrating because they've moved from one of the good pupils, the star pupils in the classroom, to actually a team that is probably going down. And they take on Mark Hughes, and you know, who is not known for being the manager who has great results to start with. The few places where he's had actually a good stint were places where he had a bit more time, and generally the beginnings were very, very difficult. And I think it's a rule. The beginnings have always been difficult with him. And it's getting a bit late in the day. And again, they missed out on a very, very good opportunity this Sunday.
Well, it's interesting you say that, because if you look down the bottom six, Stoke, West Brom and Swansea were also held up as paragons of how to run a football club properly. And they're all
very good point, no?
In very big trouble.
It's a tough run-in for Southampton as well. You look, they've got Chelsea, Bournemouth, Everton, Swansea, Leicester and Man City. That's their run-in. Are they done, do we think?
But there is always an inherent risk in that model that they have, that managers are dispensable and players are sold on for profit when they can, is that if you then screw up a couple of appointments and you screw up a window or two in the market, you're suddenly left looking very thin. Now, I have to say, the lack of direction, I think, is very true. And I think they've panicked in a big way this season. Like we've all been in situations where we panic a bit, but I don't think I've ever felt moved to appoint Mark Hughes. I think that's an excessive reaction to panic. No, I think they're certainly in trouble. Definitely.
Since the last pod, we should point out that Arsenal comprehensively beat Cisco in the Europa League 4-1. They should be safely into the semis, and on the basis they avoid Atleti, they could conceivably roll into the final and have a very good chance of winning that. All right, the end of part one. Join us in part two as we wrap up the rest of the Premier League action, get into the remarkable top of the table clash in the Championship between Cardiff and Wolves. Welcome back to Guardian Football Weekly, part two, and we'll start with Stoke and Spurs. Pochettino saying it'll be fantastic for Tottenham's new stadium to stage Champions League football in its first season after Christian Eriksen's two goals saw them overcome a battling Stoke. But will he be there next season to enjoy that Champions League football, do you think, Barry?
Richard Pochettino? Mm. I think he will, yeah. I think he's at Spurs for the long haul. Seems to be another one of those, you know, project managers. And while I imagine he will have suitors from afar, I can't see him going anywhere. It's a good game, this, actually. I thought Stoke did enough to win it. I think Stoke are definitely the best team in the bottom six, but they seem to have no luck. They keep dropping points.
With Palace? Stoke and Palace the best?
Yeah, okay, maybe Palace are better than them, but I think Stoke shouldn't be in the bottom three. I think they've played very well under Paul Lambert and just not been getting the results or the luck. And some points they've thrown away carelessly, others they've, you know, mystified as to how they haven't won games they've drawn or drawn games they've lost. Yeah, they're weird. And I thought they played outstandingly well against Spurs and again came away with nothing.
Yeah, there are a few interesting games for Stoke to come.
I meant to look up their run in.
West Ham away is next. Then Burnley at home. Then Liverpool away. Then Crystal Palace. That will be some game. And they finish with Swansea away. So and Crystal Palace is at home. So it is not exactly a simple run in to say. I mean, it would never be simple anyway, but... You're thinking,
could be worse, I think. But
it could be worse, but you see they've taken 1 point out of the last five games, which is not an awful lot. Despite the fact, again, I agree with you, it was actually so refreshing to see that game after watching the Liverpool derby.
But they missed so many chances, you know, and just one stage at the end, I think it was Mamabiram Diouf, you know, had three Stoke players to aim for, you know, all queuing up to slot home an equaliser, and he picked out the only Spurs player who was back defending, you know, at the end of a counter-attack. And that's just, you know, he was knackered, obviously, but that's just very careless. And, you know, Stoke fans must be tearing their hair, you know. But I think they have come on, improved massively under Lambert, but they're just not getting the points.
Not getting the results. 1-40, 1-14 for them. We talked to keepers earlier on. Jack Butland, he's letting 56 in 30 league games. Is there any sense if Stoke go down? Is there always a concern taking a keeper, starting a keeper that has been in goal for a team that's been relegated? There's a precedent there, of course, with David James back in the day. But playing in front of a fragile defence, that is a good or a bad thing. He's getting a workout every week.
It depends what kind of game you're going to get. And if you're talking about England here at the World Cup, you're thinking England probably won't be, apart maybe against Belgium, be in a situation, they should be in a position where they have... Control of the game. But if you're looking at English keepers who are in teams which control the game, there's a long silence. There's a long pause. I don't think there are many.
Don't forget that Jordan Pickford built his reputation playing in one of the worst teams ever to play in the Premier League. So. Right.
He's also taken a few knocks, John Pickford, certainly at the beginning of the season with Everton. But is that such a big problem? We talk about keepers. I'm less worried about Jack Butland than I am about Hugo Lloris at the moment.
Really?
I am. Because I rate Hugo Lloris extremely, extremely, extremely high. Mm. And I would actually... The last couple of seasons, and maybe last three seasons, I think he was genuinely one of the best keepers in the league, if not for some people, the best keeper, the most consistent, the most complete, and not necessarily very demonstrative and spectacular, but doing everything right. And there have been a few instances in the recent and not so recent past, certainly this season, where he has not been quite the Hugo Lloris that we're used to. And in France, it's starting to become a real talking point.
Mm.
Yeah, because you've got, you know, he's got competition there for, he's the captain of the team, okay, fine. But he hasn't been his usual self. And the goal he concedes and getting first to the ball and then knocking it the way he did when there was actually quite a lot of space to kick the ball into safety, that's a keeper who is not on top of his game.
So a chance he won't start then?
I don't think so. I think that Deschamps, what worries me is not the fact that he won't play, he will play.
Mm.
It's the fact that he's been inconsistent this season for Spurs. He hasn't been quite at the same level. He's had some fabulous games. Remember the one against Real Madrid? My goodness, in Madrid, that was fabulous. But we've seen also some very unusual mistakes for him in the recent past. So,
All right, let's move on to Bournemouth Palace, two apiece. Bournemouth, of course, just don't seem to lie down. They've won 18 points from losing positions this season. That's more than any other team in the Premier League. And comeback kings once again. It's a real heartbreaker for Crystal Palace. 60 seconds, Lars.
Yet again. I see your Stoke best team in the bottom and raise you Crystal Palace, to be honest. If they look at their recent run, their 1-0 defeat to Tottenham, the 3-2 defeat to United, the 2-1 defeat to Chelsea... And then the 2-1 defeat to Liverpool and now a draw here. How they've gotten 1 point out of those games, I have absolutely no idea. I think I've seen all of them. And of course, they wiped the floor with Huddersfield in between there as well. They've played really, really well in the last six games, basically, and they've got 4 points out of it. I feel really sorry for them.
Just one win in 10 for now. Is this the moment, do you think, Barry, that they'll look back and think their opportunity to stay up was thrown away?
I still think they will stay up, Palace. I think they're more than good enough. They've been very, very unlucky with injuries. But I think Christian Benteke was out this weekend, and I think they really benefited from that. Because they looked a lot more lively and quick and inventive up front, whereas, you know, this increasingly pathetic sight of poor old Christian lumbering around with his confidence completely shot. So I think it's a mercy that he did his groin and missed this game. I feel a bit sorry. I mean, it's a measure of how unlucky Palace are with injuries and have been this season that Conor Wickham was just back from over a year out with a cruciate, was ready, had played for the under-23s, scored on his return. A guy who has form in the history of miraculous saviour antics with Sunderland. You know, he almost single-handedly kept them up that season. Everyone thought they were doomed a few years ago. Was about to make his return to the first team, put Benteke out of his mercy, and then he has some sort of muscle injury now that's ruled him out again. Mm. So I feel very sorry for him, and I think if he'd come back, he'd possibly have saved Palace. But I still think they'll be okay.
Well, with Zaha, there's always hope as well.
There is, and they play Brighton at home at the weekend.
Huge game.
Yes, and I'll be back.
Running is on paper, I think, the best of the lot. I mean, Brighton, as you said, then it's Watford away, Leicester at home, Stoke City away, West Brom at home. So there's, you think, yeah, they can pick up points. Absolutely, they should be all right.
Fine. Let's move on to West Brom, Swansea. West Brom almost landed their fourth win of the season, which would have been their second, and their second since August. They're on a 9-game losing streak, or they were going into this. West Brom fans seem to, reveling maybe overstating it, but seem to be comfortably resigned to their fate. And there was talk of people at the game, because they were in control or winning the game anyway, for a fair chunk of it, that the fans were hanging on to that hope and in a reasonably balanced place, given their season is where it is. Swansea, on the other hand, they've still got Man City and Chelsea before the end of the month, so they're still very much right in the mix, aren't they, Lars?
Yeah. You'd think they'd have enough, to, even though their sort of incredible upturn in form under Carlos Carvalhal has sort of trailed off a little bit. It's worth remembering how doomed we thought Swansea were a couple of months ago. They've done really well to claw themselves back from that. West Bromwich, I really admire their efforts at trying to go through a season without getting more wins than managers. I think that's an admirable quest that they're on. It's something we should all support, and well done to them for managing to eke out another non-win at the weekend.
Burnley 2-1 winners over Watford. Sean Dyche saying that Burnley are still dreaming of the Europa League, and that might not be such a joke now, he says. They haven't had European competition since 1967, would you believe? But careful what you wish for, right? Because all the extra fixtures next season, if they do qualify for Europe, could be.
That was Europa League as well, which also means early start to the season, all these sort of things. Yes. Sure. It can be a little bit iffy. This said, I think that Sean Dyche is garnering more votes for manager of the season. It's extraordinary. Guardiola will win it, but I think it would probably come second, won't he?
It is remarkable. Like, as a neutral, I'm not like trekking to Burnley every weekend to watch their games, I have to admit. But what they've
and because you famously hate
that
them.
That is also true. And also, it's not true. Also, where they are, I love the purity of direction that they have at the club, where everyone completely knows what they're meant to do and everyone knows the direction they're going in, and they've got such a clear concept of what they are and how they play. And I don't think it's a coincidence that a team. We were bemoaning other teams' lack of direction. Burnley certainly have one, and they know exactly where they're going and how they're going to go about things. And it's no coincidence that they found themselves that far up the table on just a minuscule budget. It's really impressive.
And I think the whole budget, the squad cost about 2 Eliakim Mangalas, and that's about it. And by the way, they could miss out finishing seventh. They could miss out on Europe, but that would mean that Southampton would win the FA Cup.
Right.
So
I like the idea of Mangala as the new reserve currency, I think.
But it sounds like a currency too.
It's been a run on the Mangala.
For 2 or 3 seconds, I thought it was then for a minute. You said it's like
the economy is collapsing.
It was Watford's first home league defeat since December. That's an example of a mid-season managerial change that has absolutely worked. And I guess to follow your point, Lars, about identity for Burnley, Watford, you could attribute the same thing. They have a real clear style of play. Burnley have Leicester next weekend. They're challenging for the Europa League spots as well, although there are rumblings, and they went down 2-1 to Newcastle, rumblings that Claude Puel's methods are causing issue and consternation in the
game. I'm starting to wonder if there are not, I mean, if this dressing room is perhaps not the best in the Premier League, because you remember what happened with Ranieri, you remember what happened with Shakespeare, you see what is supposedly happening with Puel, whom apparently is criticised for saving them and taking them to an easy place in the top 10 and rotating his squad too much. That's ridiculous, to be honest. That sounds very much to me like the kind of story that a couple of journalists who are quite friendly with the guys who were in that team which won the title and are on good terms, and I've been leaking to the press, because it's totally insane. He's done an absolutely magnificent job.
Yeah, I think the line in one of the papers was that the team are questioning his communication methods and his team selection, which sounds to me like someone's not in the team and hasn't been told why. I'm not having this. It's nonsense.
I think Newcastle deserve immense credit for their performance. Yep.
Yes.
They're
not for the first time this season.
Great goals. Both of them. Magnificent.
Yeah. Weirdly, the Iose Perez lob,
the Totti-esque,
wasn't mentioned after in the post-game discussion of Match of the Day, which we get criticised sometimes here for not mentioning things, and I always say, well, it doesn't really matter if we don't mention it. It still happened. It was still good. But yeah, I found it a bit odd that it wasn't deemed worthy of remark. But yeah, brilliant team performance from Newcastle. And for a club, you know, that's supposedly in disarray behind the scenes, the team has put on a really united front. They all play for each other. You know, I firmly thought it was a squad that wasn't good enough to stay in the Premier League, but Rafa Benitez is really getting a tune out of a team that's clearly greater than the sum of its parts.
There's a clip doing the rounds on social media, I think about a 45 segment of that game against Leicester, in which there are about 9 or 10 50-50s close to Newcastle's box. It's astounding to watch. I mean, the hunger they have, these guys, who are honestly a championship team plus 2 or 3 players of better quality, or maybe 3 or 4, is simply remarkable. I mean, what they could achieve, that club, with this manager and the captain they've got, who again was superb.
Going to need the backing, of course. And there was some reports, we were chatting about it yesterday, Lars, linking Rafa with the Real Sociedad gig, which is bizarre. But there are going to be reports linking him with various gigs until he feels the investment's there, the future's there. And that's something that...
Well, it's a miracle that he stayed so long already. I mean,
that story, I think, also suggested that the talks have resumed with Amanda Staveley, who was rumoured to be taking over. Newcastle fans obviously rubbished and poo-pooed the story on Twitter, but the journalist who wrote it, I can't remember his name, I'm sorry, but he insisted, you know, that he has good sources for the story and it's not nonsense or made up nonsense.
Well, now that relegation has been staved off, the negotiations can start for good, because I think that they more or less stumbled on that particular point. We want guarantees that if and so forth, but why not?
Finally, the Premier League game is Brighton 1, Huddersfield 1. Talk of Brighton looking quite nervy in that one, I guess, particularly with the game they got at the weekend that, Lars, you're heavily against them on. But they're okay, ultimately, aren't they, with win or lose this weekend?
Probably, in terms of where they are points-wise in the table.
But have you seen who they're playing?
I am a little bit worried.
It is
frightening.
Their fixture list is not great, and they've now dropped points in the kind of... I mean, this is the Huddersfield at home. You need to be winning that, I think, given how Huddersfield have looked recently.
Crystal Palace away. Okay.
Yeah, not good.
Tottenham. Burnley away. Manchester United, Manchester City, and Liverpool.
So right. Let me revise my assessment.
Likewise. So they could very feasibly
get no points from that.
Yeah. I mean, they've got 35, and I think there's a kind of consensus that 39? Using all these algorithms, no, this season 36 could and should be okay.
But they could be reaching for that, right? I mean, it's a horrible fixture list. Those big teams
at the end of the running, you wonder, you know, there's a possibility they'll have no motivation to play particularly well and could well lose. They might not care. You know, it's human nature.
They might not play with the same intensity. Liverpool, if they're still in the Champions League, who knows, might play and would play a weakened team.
Yeah.
Yes, you can look at that and think that there is a silver lining somewhere. By the way, if I say Liverpool, that would mean Liverpool are in the final of the Champions League.
Okay.
Which I have a bet on. So.
And of course, Southampton and Stoke need to pick up a good number of points to overtake them. Same with the other teams. But yeah, that's grimmer than I was aware. My apologies. Mm. They might not be okay at all.
Likewise. Well, I think I led you into that. All right then, let's move on to the Football League. And I'll start with the Championship. Big wins at the bottom as Barnsley pulled within 2 points of safety with a 3-2 win over Sheffield United. Hull and Reading got vital wins as well to distinguish themselves in the relegation battle. But of course, the big result came on Friday night as second place Cardiff hosted top of the table Wolves. Wolves went ahead in the 67th minute before incredibly giving away two penalties in injury time. John Ruddy saving a 94th minute penalty. 2 minutes later, Junior Hoylett hit the bar in the 96th minute. Two penalties squandered by Cardiff. Wolves boss Nuno Espirito Santo ran onto the pitch afterwards to celebrate with his team before eventually shaking his counterpart's hand. Neil Warnock did not appreciate that in the slightest. He wouldn't accept his apology afterwards, saying, "I don't accept it at all. I went to shake his hand, but he ran off. If that's how they're taught in Portugal, then fair enough, but not in Britain." And he went on to say, "They've won the game. They should shake your hand and say unlucky or something." Not run off like that and rub your noses in it.
Straight into says it. Unlucky or something. Oh, next time.
Be literal there.
If Nuno is up to it, next time after playing Neil Warnock, he needs to shake his hand and say unlucky or something.
He really should. A disgrace, he punctuated it with. Carsten asked us via Twitter, is that the most ironic comment ever in the history of football, given Warnock's own embarrassing history of behaviour?
Well, if there's a more entertaining clip from the weekend than Nuno forlornly traipsing after Neil Warnock with his hand outstretched, being repeatedly told to F off for 20 seconds. I haven't seen it. I must say I like Neil Warnock. I find him very entertaining. I've met him a couple of times or spoken to him a couple of times, and I've no axe to grind with him, but yeah, I can understand why he's very unpopular. And he does have a long history of petulance and poor behaviour. But as I say, I like the guy. Nuno does seem genuinely apologetic. I think the same thing has happened before with Tony Pulis. And
you can sympathise with him the way that game finished. Yeah, I mean, carried away.
Yeah, of course you can. But, you know, Warnock was obviously not happy about a number of things.
Sure.
And there now looks to be a very real possibility that Cardiff are going to get reeled in by Fulham.
Yeah, which, they won again.
By mighty Fulham.
Who haven't lost in 19.
Yeah, fabulous.
And their fans must be getting very frustrated because they just keep winning and they can't catch Cardiff. Right. But now it looks like they might.
Only 4 points now.
It's only two.
2 points. Yes, yeah, 2 points goodness. Away.
Yeah. And Cardiff have to play Aston Villa tomorrow night, which won't be easy. Tip of the hat also to Millwall, who've turned into a relentless winning machine and look playoff bound. So
2-0 win for them over Bristol City.
Because this one thing which puzzles me, the glass of wine with the opposition manager. So which kind of wines you should choose, which colour, which temperature. Mm. And also, when do they exactly do it? I've been asking myself this question. You know, it's like, why is the sea salty? Why is the sky blue? Where do they find the time to have this glass of wine? Because as soon as the game is over, they go in their own dressing room. Then they do their media duties, which in England, not Britain, in England, take at least an hour, if not an hour and a half. Then
so
they've got
to Wales.
So they've got. Then afterwards, they go on to the team bus. So when do they have this drink?
So it's a very important and interesting question. I was also thinking how many, when you're talking about the wine selection, how many managers right now in the Football League go for the wine in the box?
Okay.
I mean,
or serve them in pint, glasses like Sam.
In a pint glass, the double whammy.
Just as a member of the media, I would love for whatever they usually do have the glass of wine, I want it moved forward to before they do their media obligations. I think that could improve our lives hugely. Just a whole...
Depends on your deadline.
Or expand beyond wine to cocktails, shots.
Yeah.
Maybe that would solve the problem if it's shots. Yeah. That won't take long.
Shots before media interviews after the game, I think is the way to go.
Solved it. Now, Barry mentioned Sambuca. Limoncello before media interviews.
Sambuca. Big Sambuca.
Oh, nice. Yeah.
Tequila Slammers.
Oh, no.
Tequila Slammers, yeah, definitely.
Yeah. Millwall's win over Bristol City, as Barry mentioned earlier, that keeps them in the playoff mix, but Derby and Middlesbrough won as well.
Actually, how many drinks are named after football players, like Jack Daniels, like Jack Wilshere and Chani Daniels?
Oh, that's a bit of homework for our listeners.
Yeah, anyway. We'll
fire that out. Let us know.
I mean, Glenn Fiddish, I don't know, is there a Fiddish somewhere? Glenn Murray, yeah, and nice. Something Fiddish? Mm. Anyway, carry on.
You can work on that while I rattle through the rest of the Football League.
Sorry.
League One, the top 5-1. Wigan, the biggest scoreline. Will Grigg scoring a hat-trick in their 5-1 win over the MK Dons. Blackpool beat Bradford 5-0 to help pull away from the relegation zone. 4 points separate Northampton in 23rd and Oldham in 19th. None of the five teams in that mix got a win, but three of them picked up draws, most notably Rochdale, who led no fewer than three times against Portsmouth, only for left-back Matt Dunn to head one into his own net off the bar in the 92nd minute.
AFC Wimbledon are now 1 point ahead of MK Dons, who are in the relegation zone.
I think Andy Brassel somewhere is smiling. In League Two, the top 6-1, Lincoln climbing into fifth at the expense of Coventry. They lost fifth-placed Notts County. Huge win for Barnet under Martin Allen once again for the 27th time in history. Currently in 23rd, one of the relegation spots, but they beat the team directly above them, Forest Green Rovers, to close the gap to 4 points. So there are four games left for Barnet to make an unlikely escape. That's two wins in three. And all four of their remaining fixtures are against teams in the bottom half, including their final game of the season, which is at home to bottom of the table, Chesterfield.
Let's not forget that Lincoln didn't play because they played in another competition and won it.
They did. The Czech Trade Trophy. A big win for Lincoln. Elsewhere, Accrington Stanley won 1-0 at Colchester, to say 3 points clear of Luton. More significant, though, I think, than that was the news that Accrington were warned of their conduct by the EFL after Chairman Andy Holt was investigated following his reveal that he gives his captain, Sean McConville, money to get the team a McDonald's on the way home when they win. And the EFL have contested there was no provision for results-based payments within the club's bonus schedule. So it's good to see them concentrating on the important things. In other words, they should be getting McDonald's win or lose. Sean McConville said, sometimes when we win, he gives £200 to us, less the £21.37 he has to give back in change. So there you go. Accrington Stanley getting a slap on the wrist from the EFL.
Yeah, I'll never tire of repeating this. This is the same EFL which passed Mr. Marinakis as a fit and proper person to run a football club.
They sound like a bunch of nuggets.
In part three, we'll get you up to speed on all the key news from around Europe, La Liga, the Bundesliga, Serie A and League One. That is coming next. Okay, let's round up La Liga's weekend now with Sid Lowe. Hey, Sid.
How you doing?
Very well indeed. And I want to start with the Madrid derby, because there were concerns that it was going to be a bit of a dead rubber, given both teams' focus on their respective European competitions and they're out of the title race, of course. But it lived up to some hype, I guess. Ronaldo grabbing the headlines again, scoring for their 10th straight time. What did you make of the 1-1 draw?
Yeah, it was. It was quite enjoyable. And I think it was a game where actually Real Madrid played pretty well. And obviously the focus has been largely on the saves that Oblak made throughout the game. It's true that Madrid lost control and really quite badly, actually, after they'd scored the goal. And it was 15, 20 minutes when Atletico Madrid didn't just equalise but could have scored again. But largely Madrid played pretty well. I suppose the way in which the game's importance was relative is demonstrated by the fact that Cristiano Ronaldo was taken off just after the hour, and Zidane said afterwards, you know, this is part of the process now. We are going to rest him. He doesn't have to play every game. He can't play every game. And I think that tells you that while this mattered, and both teams played as if it mattered, albeit maybe a little bit more free than they might have been if it had been absolutely decisive. So maybe that even made it a better game. But I think that shows that it was of relative importance. Perhaps in a way, it almost looks more important, you know, 3 or 4 hours after the game, when Valencia win, because Valencia are now ahead of Madrid in the league. Madrid are down to fourth.
That's going to be interesting, isn't it? We heard a lot about how Ronaldo's been handled in the last 18 months or so, certainly under Zidane, in terms of being rested, something that was, I guess, inconceivable a few years back. And you look at the stats and how prolific he's been, it's absolutely paying off. But you're right, it does make that a more challenging situation if they progress in the Champions League, because they don't have comfort in La Liga. So Ronaldo might need to factor a little bit more than perhaps Zidane would want him to in the run-in.
Yeah, possibly. Although, I mean, I suppose you look at it, and they did this even last year. I mean, last year they were chasing for a league title, and in the end they won it. And it's I'm going to get my stats wrong here, but I think last year was only the second league title in 8 years. So it was genuinely a big deal. But of the last 7 weeks away from home, Ronaldo missed out 4 of them. So it wasn't just that he wasn't playing, it was he was being told, right, you don't travel. You stay at home, you clear your mind, you keep well away from this. You know, we don't have you on the bench kind of chomping at the bit to get on. And obviously last year, it's true that they probably had a little bit more strength in depth because they had Morata and James Rodriguez who played a key role. But Madrid went for mass rotations last year when they were going for two competitions, and it really worked. Perhaps this year it would be less likely to succeed. The other thing, I suppose, is whether Zidane looks at the table and thinks, look, realistically, does it matter if you finish fourth or third rather than second? You still get a Champions League play to play for now. So that will matter up to a point. But I still think the fundamental thing, and there's no two ways about this, is that he will be keen to keep Ronaldo fit for those Champions League games, and probably still believe that even if Ronaldo doesn't play, he has more than sufficient players to win the league games. I mean, bear in mind that, you know, this is a Madrid side that, for example, in the last Champions League game had Lucas Vazquez, Marco Asensio and Gareth Bale all starting on the bench.
Sure.
You know, it's not a bad set of players to have in reserve, even right. if Ronaldo dominates everything they do.
Well, he is doing that very much at the moment. Of course, 26 in the last 14, 40 for Real Madrid this season in just 37 games. And given his personal frustration at some of his recent performances, it's no surprise that Lionel Messi didn't sit out against Leganes. And no coincidence, is it, Sid, that he bags a hat-trick in their 3-1 win, given what his old sparring partner's up to at the moment?
Well, I mean, in a way, I suppose with Messi, maybe the response to that is to say it's no coincidence that he scored a hat-trick just because he's just at a ludicrously good level at the moment.
Sure.
And Messi has been absolutely brilliant all season. And I think there is a concern from some Barcelona fans, I think possibly even from Valverde himself, about how much Messi is playing. But the dependency they have on him, and it's not just the goals, it's everything they do. And you watch Barcelona, and for a team with very, very good players, because, you know, let's not forget they do have some other players who are pretty good, it's really startling how often they look to Messi. You know, their plan, I know this is deliberately reductionist, but there's something in it. Their plan is get the ball and give it to Messi. I mean, that's kind of what they do. And he has been just on a different level to anyone this season, because not just because of the goals, but because of everything that goes with it. And they do look like a team that's kind of a little bit bereft of ideas when he's not inspired. But it's also true that, you know, there's been physical doubts. He missed the 2 Argentina games. He came on as a sub immediately after international break. And of course, in half an hour, helped Barcelona score 2 against Sevilla when they were 2-0 down to rescue this unbeaten and run. He played this weekend, and Valverde said, look, it's good for him to play, it's good to get in contact with the ball. So I'm not that surprised that he played, but I must say I'm a little bit surprised that he played the whole game. I'm a little bit surprised that they pushed him for that long. I guess at 2-0 up, my reaction was, well, you know, you take him off now. Leganes scores, so it's 2-1, so maybe it's a bit closer and you don't risk it. But they, I think they will look and see if there's any opportunity to rest him as much as they can. But next week, Valencia, which is relatively tough. The week after that, midweek, they go away to Celta. So I suspect he plays in both of those games. And they do need to think about it carefully. There's no doubt about that. You look at the statistics this year, and I think I'm right in saying that Messi's played 10 games more than Cristiano Ronaldo, given that we're focusing this on the kind of the direct comparison between the two.
You mentioned Valencia and it's an extraordinary season for them as well. Champions League football seems assured. And when you consider, I mean, a great club, a massive club, but the disarray and dysfunction that it's had over recent years, credit has to go to Marcelino for a remarkable turnaround.
Yeah, it really does. And he said after the game this weekend, He said, you know, what this group of players is doing is a miracle. To which Rodrigo, the striker who scored, I think, for the fifth game in a row, came out and said the opposite. He said, no, it's not a miracle. This is a result of really, really hard work. It's a result of a really good squad. And what Marcelino's done, I think, has been really, really impressive. I mean, beyond, obviously, the coaching, beyond, obviously, the physical preparation, because he's a manager who is absolutely obsessed with diet, with fitness, with weight. I mean, you know, obviously, every professional manager has a, you know, has a kind of a close look on the physical condition of his players. But Marcelino pushes it, even within football, he's recognised within the game. Almost people kind of laugh at it as being kind of obsessed with this, you know, to the extent that he wants the body fat index to be a couple of percentage points lower than most clubs would push for. You know, normally it's around about 11-12%. He's aiming at 9 with his players and is very, very strict about that. But even beyond that, I think there's a kind of an emotional management of the squad and an organisation that he's done. And this begins, I mean, it sounds very unpleasant and I dislike words like this, but it begins with a purge in a way. It begins with a clean out of the squad. It begins in the summer with him saying, right, if we're going to do this right, it has to be about attitude. It has to be about approach. And so some players have to go, even if we think they're talented, and we have to change the culture at the club. And I think that's really what most stands out when you look at what Martin has done, is that he's been able to change the culture at Valencia and make them really serious again. And I think when you look back at it, I mean, you know, kind of let's put English glasses on for a moment. When you look back at it, and I think that Gary Neville would recognise some of the problems that Martino faced and will feel, I mean, I don't know whether he'll feel disappointed or pleased, but he will certainly think that was something that needed to happen when I was there. Of course, his problem was that he came halfway through the season. Lots of other managers had institutional problems at Valencia as well. This time, I think Marcelino came in and was given the support and the authority and the backing to do it, because they changed at presidential level, they changed at director general level as well, at CEO level. And so there was a real sense in the summer, right, we're going to do this properly and we're going to do it seriously. And if that means making tough decisions, if that means, frankly, shedding a whole load of players that we think are talented, but we just don't want here, then we're going to do it. And it's been a huge, huge success.
Terrific stuff. Thanks, Sid. Appreciate it.
My pleasure.
We've all got, or aiming at least for 9 to 10% body fat, like Marcelino insists from his players, right?
I'm not.
Something to strive for anyway. That's La Liga. Let's get the latest on the Bundesliga now from Archie Rintoot.
So with 5 games left to play in the season, Bayern Munich confirmed their 6th consecutive Bundesliga title, a 4-1 win over Augsburg on Saturday, despite 7 changes to Jupp Heynckes' starting lineup from their win against Sevilla. Now, one of them was Niklas Süle at centre-back, and in return, he came up with one of the own goals of the season. Not that he knew much about it. After Sven Ulreich had made a save, the ball smacked him straight in the face and bounced in. That did seem to wake Bayern up, though. Corentin Tolisso and James Rodriguez put them ahead by half-time, before Ian Robben and Sandro Wagner added a bit of second-half gloss. So come full-time, they were doing the conga in front of their fans, with the cardboard cutout of the Bundesliga trophy, the Meisterschale. They'll get the real thing on the final day of the season. Next up, though, it's the second leg of their Champions League quarter-final against Sevilla on Wednesday. They lead 2-1, heading back to Munich. As for the rest of the division, start up north with the big shock of the weekend, Hamburg ending a 15-game winless streak against in-form Schalke. A very entertaining 3-2 win, with Aaron Hunt's 30-yard strike into the top corner minutes from time well worth seeking out. Now, that win saw them leapfrog Cologne in the automatic relegation places. Cologne played Mainz, current occupants of the relegation playoff spot. They could have closed the gap on them to 3 points, but drew 1-1, so the gap remains 6, and the feeling is that Cologne are down, even if they are just 1 point below Hamburg. Shout out for Liverpool only Divock Origi. A delightful backheel nutmeg helped set up Wolfsburg's winner, a 2-0 victory over Freiburg, to push Wolfsburg 2 points above Mainz. Back up the top, Dortmund, thumped by Bayern last weekend, got back on track with a 3-0 win over Stuttgart. Michy Batshuayi on target there. Christian Pulisic too, with a cross which turned into a spectacular opener. Dortmund now just a point behind Schalke, ahead of facing them next Sunday in the Revier Derby. Looks like they'll join Bayern in the Champions League next season, Dortmund and Schalke that is, plus 1 of 4, either Frankfurt or Hoffenheim, who drew 1-1 on Sunday, or Leipzig and Leverkusen, who play on Monday night. Just 3 points separate that quartet after Sunday's games.
An exciting weekend in Serie A too, as the title race stays just about alive, breathing and whatever we said with the fish. Here's Paolo Bandini with more.
Fiorentina's 2-0 victory away to Roma on Saturday means they have now won 6 games in a row, their best run since 1960. That'd be an extraordinary thing at any time, but it's even more so in this case for the fact that the last five of those games have been played after the sudden death of their captain, Davide Astori. Both players and coaches do see these things as linked. Manager Stefano Pioli spoke last week about how the team had become more united since Astori's passing, but I think it's also really important that we guard against depicting this as some sort of cheesy redemption story. A man is dead, and nobody at Fiorentina thinks that winning games is somehow going to bring him back. But if you listen to the way that players are speaking, and in particular Ricky Saponara, who gave a really frank account to Sportweek magazine, the honest truth is that they don't really know what else to do. You've got guys admitting they don't want to go home after training because that would mean confronting life. So instead what they do is they stay and they work even harder. So it's a remarkable story in one sense, but in another I think it's actually very relatable for many of us who've gone through grief in our lives. The idea that sometimes it's easier to throw yourself into work than to do anything else. In any case, the win moved them up to seventh in the table, put them on course for a place in Europe, which is something that looked like a very distant goal even as recently as a month ago. Roma slipped to fourth. They are overtaken by Lazio ahead of the derby. And Inter dropped out of the top four after they were beaten by Torino, while Milan missed a chance to gain ground on them because they drew with Sassuolo. So there's a lot of drop points for the teams at the top of the table, but it's as you were for the very top two, Juventus and Napoli. But even then, only just. Napoli were losing 1-0 at home to Chievo until the 89th minute, but turned it around thanks to late goals from Arkadiusz Milik and Amadou Diawara.
And in France, this could have been the weekend that PSG regained the title, Philippe Auclair, but things didn't exactly go to plan, did they?
No, they had a game to forget, really, at Saint-Étienne. Saint-Étienne, which is totally transformed since Gasset has taken over. And it's a game they should have lost, really. I mean, they took a point at Geoffroy Guichard only through a own goal by Mathieu Debuchy in the second minute of added time, having had Kimpembe sent off, having seen Rémi Cabella, who opened the scoring, miss a penalty, and you know, you can carry on like that. It was really a very good performance by Saint-Etienne, yet another one, finishing the season really very impressively indeed.
They've had a curious season, really, haven't they? Because it started so promising.
Yeah.
I was at the corresponding fixture in Paris at the start of the season, and everybody was talking up Saint-Etienne as being contenders. Then, of course, they went in there. Mid-season funk, made changes, but they've rebounded and possibly looking at a European berth.
Well, I'm looking at that. It's perhaps a little bit too far because, you know, you've got ahead of them, you've got, if you're looking, we're talking, of course, Europa League spot.
Yeah.
Because for the Champions League, apart from a PSG and Monaco, we've got Lyon and Marseille. More about this in a second.
Right.
Otherwise, it's Rennes, Montpellier, Nice, Nantes and Saint-Etienne are in the mixer. For a spot in or two in the Europa League, I think it's probably the game also told us quite a bit about PSG and the way that their season is genuinely, you know, it's
petering
tough,
out.
Isn't it? Yeah, it's petering out. It's petering out.
And Cavani getting a lot of criticism for that.
Yeah, completely. Well, he as soon as something doesn't go well for PSG, the fans, the plastic fans, go for Edinson Cavani, who is only about the greatest player in the history of their club. But apart from that, never mind.
Yeah.
Because, yes, it's true that Cavani sometimes misses chances. It's true that he's sometimes not as clinical as people would like him to be. That's totally absurd. I mean, to put the weight of defeat or a draw or disappointment on the shoulder of Cavani is just insane, really, basically. But it was fairly lively weekend, perhaps lively year, especially for you chaps.
Yeah.
Oh, did I say something I shouldn't have said here?
Yeah.
Yes, because there was a bit of a... I mean, the most interesting thing, apart, of course, from this Saint-Etienne draw, which, by the way, I should mention that very quickly, the fact that Mathieu Debuchy scored an own goal shouldn't detract from the fact that he's been fantastic with Saint-Etienne ever since he's joined from Arsenal. The own goal, again, you know, what can he do? But he's actually on course to be in the squad for the World Cup, which is quite a turnaround when you think about the years that he wasted, there's no other word, at Arsenal. It's been terrific, both going forward and defending, especially defending, which is one of the reasons why Didier Deschamps, I think, will take him. And I actually wouldn't be surprised if he started.
Wow.
We have real problems at right back and at left back. We've got people who can bomb forward, you know, like Sidibe, and we don't have players who are good at defending.
And Debussy certainly very good at that. But otherwise, yes, it was quite funny what happened at the Velodrome. I mean, unless you were a Marseille supporter.
Or
a,
yes, exactly.
Huh? Would you say
Oh, you were called... yes.
Speculating, I think, is
yes.
what we
were at. Yeah.
Just changing the subject.
Well,
would you say that Saint-Étienne have gotten a tune out of Debussy? God, that works.
Yes, no. I was just trying to think of a good quip, but yes, obviously. No, I mean, obviously, Montpellier did you a bad turn, and they did Marseille a bad turn, especially since Lyon had won a very, very impressive victory indeed at Metz before that. If Priya was with us today, she will tell us more about what's happening to Memphis Depay, because he's absolutely on fire.
Yeah.
4 assists, which I think is in a single game, which is a record this season in the whole of Europe, plus a goal himself. And this Lyon team, you know, derided at some point. I was looking as well at the players they've got in the top 10 of goal scorers in France. They've got 3. Mariano Diaz, mm-hmm. 17 goals. Nabil Fekir, 16, and Memphis Depay, 13. Mm. His stats for the season are just prodigious, especially for a player who is often accused of being very selfish and looking for, you know, is after his own interests. And so Lyon have now leapfrogged Marseille for the third non-automatic qualification.
Who do you think will last the course there?
Lyon, I would put my money on Lyon. And again, there's this fragility about Marseille these days. They had a great opportunity to do something. You know, Montpellier are the drawing kings of Ligue 1. This was their 16th draw of the season. And they still have a chance. You know, there are still 6 games to go. With a little effort, they could establish an all-time record. Which I think is 20 by Bordeaux about 13 years ago. So they could establish a new record. But, you know, Marseille had chances. Montpellier had chances to nick it, by the way, at the end too. Dimitri Payet had a poor game, was substituted. I know, not very inspiring all that. And nothing is done, of course. There's still 6 games to go, but... it's a duel between now Lyon and the OM.
Okay, terrific stuff. Thanks, Philippe. Leaves us with just any other business. I've got a tweet here from Phil who asks, what are your thoughts on WrestleMania 34 and do you want to see Undertaker versus John Cena next year? Okay, thanks, fellas. And how are we getting on with managers that sound like drinks? Have we any progress on that?
I think Tony Pulini-Montrachet.
Nice.
I think... is one. And Nuno Espirito Santo is a drink
anyway.
It's
a no-brainer.
It's got to be a drink.
I want a cocktail named after Kenny Jacket by the time I'm back here, which might be a while. Speaking of which, Max is back on Thursday for Guardian Football Extra. Any other business from you, Barry? Cork City, did you want to mention?
Oh, yeah. Well, there was an interesting game over the weekend in Ireland in the top flight. Waterford took on Cork City in a match that saw the ref dish out 6 red cards.
Just the six.
Waterford beat Cork 2-1. And in the knockings of added time in the second half, there was a dispute. One of the Waterford players wouldn't give the ball back for a Cork City throw-in. Cork obviously frantically needed the ball back to try and get a late equaliser. And in the ensuing hoopla, 2 of the players on the pitch got red cards. 1 unused substitute got a red card. 1 player who had been on but had been taken off after a man of the match performance.
Brilliant.
He got a red card, and both managers got red cards. So, fun and games
stuff.
In Waterford.
Sounds it.
Just one other thing in FITBA news, Scottish Premier League, the annual split. Happens this week. Fixtures will be announced. Top 6, bottom 6 play out their own little mini leagues. I think Kilmarnock still have to play Hamilton before all teams have completed the 33 games, but the half of the division, their halves are already decided. Nothing can change there. And this split creates an imbalance. Like we're going to be in a position where Hibs will almost certainly have to play a third match this season away at Ibrox, you know, which is kind of unfair, but these things happen. And Brendan Rodgers wants the league organisers to make... Celtic need 1 win to wrap up the title, and Brendan Rodgers wants the game to be against Rangers. But... Scottish football officials will probably avoid this because of the famous match in, I think it was 1999, that led to when Rangers clinched the title at Celtic in a match that took place at 6:05 in the evening on a bank holiday weekend.
Right.
So there were scenes of incredible drunkenness, 360 police incidents, 113 arrests, a riot on Duke Street, one stabbing, a referee finishing the match with 4 stitches after being hit by a coin thrown from the Celtic end, 3 red cards, and Rangers winning the title. Difficult to see them going for that game.
Marginally less eventful than the Cork game by the sound of it. Terrific stuff. Thanks, Barry. And indeed, thanks, Lars Philippe, as well. Really enjoyed your company over the last 5 hours. We'll sort it out in the edit, I'm sure. By we, I mean producer Jonathan. Max is back on Thursday, so look forward to that. We'll see you next time.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.